Hi, everyone. It's Dean Haglund from the office's Rational Exuberance here in the heart of the historic core of downtown Los Angeles in the middle of the Eastern Columbia Building. This is your chill pack Hollywood hour, and I am your host, along with your co-host, Mr. Phil Lernes, ladies and gentlemen.
You were going so fast because you knew that we have an action-packed show.
Action-packed.
One that I've been looking forward to. And then you slowed down a little bit and you slightly altered the name of the show because, after all, it has been cold in Los Angeles. Cold enough to warrant putting the chili in the chili pack. Hollywood Hour. I got nothing. I am your co-host, your friend in podcasting.
Mr. Nuffity Nuff.
A violence prevention specialist.
The Interrupter.
I don't know. Podiatrist to the stars.
No, you're not.
Phil Lernes.
That's Dr. Roger Lear.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's podiatrist.
I like how he thought when we first met that maybe we were related, even
because
though by the first four letters of our last name, we're related.
Could happen.
Yeah. My last name's made up, as I've told you before.
Yes, I love that story.
Anyway, you know, we have so much to cover, so much to get to, and yet we promised that we would, in fact, cover last week's development news. So I think we'll get to that very near the top.
Very good.
However, all of it involves television. And if we're going to discuss what's going on in TV these days, how about the fact that for the first time in 17 years, David Letterman beat Jay Leno and rather sizably in the November sweeps.
Really?
For the first time in 17 years. Now, of course, was it 2 years ago now? I don't remember when it was Conan that he beat.
Right.
So The Late Show has beat The Tonight Show, but it's the first time in 17 years he beat The Tonight Show with Jay Leno in the November sweeps.
I am
which
shocked.
Which is a big deal.
I am shocked that anybody still watches Jay Leno.
Well, no, apparently they're not. I mean, the audience size from year to year has plummeted for The Tonight Show, as it has for Jimmy Fallon.
Yeah.
Letterman's audience size took a little bit of a dip, stayed even, roughly. The one person whose audience has grown in late-night television, Craig Ferguson, late show with Craig Ferguson, which beat for the first time ever in a sweeps period, a whole month. And these sweeps periods, for people who are not familiar with the business, it's one of 3 months where the television industry
goes
pays
crazy.
Real attention to the ratings, where the ratings actually matter, because all the advertising rates for the 30-second, 60-second spots, et cetera, both local and national, where they are set. So you want to be number one during those months.
And you want to do crazy stunts. You do
whatever you have to do.
And you promote the hell out of it, and everybody's supposed to watch.
So anyway, I thought that's big news. I mean, Craig Ferguson has so silently become... I mean, he was always solid. He was always good. But he has so silently built up such an enthusiastic following.
Well, yeah, because his show is different enough. He actually improvises his monologue. He's not doing... I mean, geez, how tired are the jokes on Leno and Letterman these days?
Out of the joke book
I had in the 70s, for crying out loud.
Well, Ferguson is a man who has lived an interesting life, of course. And he talks about that, and he talks about it sometimes fairly seriously. But he always has fun with it.
And he's a bit goofy.
And
kids love the goofy.
And he's an interesting guy who has worked in many different facets of the
biz.
The business.
Yeah.
As opposed to someone who has simply sat behind a desk.
Did stand up and then sat behind a desk for the rest of it.
Now, that said, it is kind of nice to see that the appeal of Letterman is kind of back on top in the sense that, you know, as we've talked about before, the way that David Letterman and other people of his era would talk about Johnny Carson, there are a whole lot of people who are making and shaping television right now who feel that way about him.
Yeah.
And we will be on your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour 40 years from now.
Exactly.
We will be talking about David Letterman the way that we speak about Jack Parr, the way that we speak about Ernie Kovacs.
Absolutely. And that's the thing. Letterman's getting older. The demographic's getting older. So naturally, they're all resolving. They're migrating to his own demographic.
You talk about the demographics, and of course, we've been talking about the disappearance of young people.
Yes.
Where entertainment industry is concerned, where all the young people go.
They're playing 16 hours of tour of duty.
It's two things. There might be things that are taking them away from television, film, etc. Also, they are a diminishing demographic.
Right.
This culture is getting older.
Right.
We are, on average, much older than 50 years of age in this country. So they are disappearing. They are an endangered species.
Right. Exactly. And, that's a good point.
And, you know, we brought up over the last few shows, right, occasionally, the concept of why was it ever okay to try to exploit that group to begin with? Why were advertisers trying to exploit that group? Why were film companies trying to exploit that group? Why are we trying to get every last nickel out of the one group that we should be letting keep their money?
Right.
So that they don't spend their whole lives in debt.
Right.
And maybe that's the reason. So that they will spend their whole lives in debt. But the issue with late night television, I think in some regards, of course, and maybe the only important regard, never mind cultural or historic significance, it probably does just get down to demographics.
I think so.
And NBC is a disaster right now. And meanwhile, CBS led the big four networks. CBS traditionally has always skewed old with its programming. And there's, of course, nothing wrong with that as a culture ages. And,
why not have that be number one? Then,
and as those shows might actually lend themselves to interesting stories. And now I don't know. I don't watch anything on CBS. I'm not old enough. However,
in your face.
I also don't watch anything on NBC because I'm not young enough and I can read.
You're strictly Fox then.
Well, thank you very much, Dean Hack. But I do like to think I'm getting handsomer as I get older.
No,
you
I mean
the watch
Fox Network. Yeah. No,
awkward.
It's really awkward in here.
Disappointing. Now your true feelings were finally coming out. No, but this disaster of NBC programming, of course, gets right back to how much they are determined to try to appeal to a young demographic that may not exist anymore.
May not exist. I mean, it's true. And if you go chasing that and they don't exist and you find out at the end of the road, that is a lot of energy to run to a dead end.
Oh, my goodness. Now, we have not had this segment in a long time. We've introduced so many new segments.
So many new segments on the show.
But I just made that cheap off-the-cuff joke about, you know, I don't watch NBC because I'm actually capable of reading. What are we reading? Dean Haglund, what are you reading?
I am reading The History of France Through Art. I am fascinated. I bought this at the Rose Bowl flea market. It is a fantastic book from the 80s, and it is basically the entire history of France through different art pieces and the artists themselves. And I am finding so much information out that I did not know. Like all the Impressionists hung out at one cafe. Did you know that? That's how they all met. They hung out at one single cafe. It wasn't that they were going to the same art school or that they were all refused from the salon and then they all gathered. It was that they were all in this one cafe in Paris.
What I love about this is that I feel to a very real degree that the history of humanity is the history of art, as much as one might want to think of it as the history of war or the history of destruction or the history of invention, how often does history use as its signposts art movements and major works of art?
Absolutely. And this is why I'm also painting on canvas again, because I fear that in the future, all of this digital technology, as we record here and our laptops are open, all of that will be lost. As you said, or who said it, the most famous person will be the one who handwrites a diary.
You know, because
in the future, of course,
my favorite, you know, Tolstoy quote that I'm sure I'm bastardizing, but you know, you can never know history because you can never know a man. You can't know what is inside them. You really can't.
Right.
So the closest you can come is either study the events,
or the expression,
the expression of what's going on inside them, which comes back to a large degree the stories that they tell, either through novels or plays or in our case films, and through painting. I mean, this is telling stories and sculpture. However, they are expressing those. And of course, then speeches and political letters. Though if you really want to know the spirit of an age, you may not be wise to be looking directly to the leadership of that age, because that may not actually reflect.
In fact, more often than not, it's a little behind.
Well, that's fascinating.
Yes. What are you reading?
I finally read, I had never read this before, and I picked this up at Lightly Used Books in Turlock, California.
Ah,
which we
lovely
about.
Turlock, yes.
Dashiell Hammett's The Continental Law.
Ah, Continental Law.
Series of short stories. And this is a riveting, if sometimes disturbingly racist, but it's of its age.
Of its age.
It is of its age. 19,
1930?
Early 1920s.
20s, yeah.
Based very much on Dashiell Hammett's own experiences as a detective for, really? For a large detective agency.
Now, Continental Op is the character whose only redeeming value is he can take a punch.
Well, kind of. That's a little... He's really good at what he does.
Yes.
He's really good at
what
he does.
He's not average and then just gets punched out a lot when he gets
close.
But
he is average in terms of he's short, he's what you could say, kindly, you could call him stocky.
Okay.
He's not a bodybuilder. He's not an action star. He's just single-minded and determined, and he's going to get the job done. Ah. And he does have a certain code. And anyway, what struck me in reading all these stories is how much they would really lend themselves to being an amazing television series.
I can't believe... Well, I think that's sort of how... I mean, not canon, but...
and do period action. San Francisco, 1920s. I mean, if Martin Scorsese can do 1920s Atlantic City,
yep.
Someone on one of these networks like HBO
should be doing Continental Op. We just sold a pitch.
There are enough stories in that only collection. Yep. There are enough stories for a first season.
Wow. And did you go by City Hall on the way here today? There was hundreds of 1928 and 40 up to, I think the latest model was a 1940 Ford in front of City Hall. They were doing a period piece, a full feature film, and driving on the bus through that, it looked like I was thrown back 60 years.
I did actually, believe it or not, read about, before going to bed last night, reading about Henry Ford.
Henry Ford.
So that's interesting. Not my favorite human to ever walk the planet.
I'm made a lovely car.
Honorary member of the Nazi Party,
friend of Edison,
huge influence on the Nazis, Fordism, as it was also the villain in, of course, Aldous Huxley's Brave New World. The man who published the Protocols of the Elders of Zion in this country and published his anti-Jewish screed and gave them away to 50,000 proud Ford owners for free.
Made an affordable car.
One of the worst enemies of unions that this country's ever seen.
He allowed... I got nothing. You're right. I don't know anything about this guy.
Anyone who is as opposed to the assembly line approach to food,
right,
as you are.
Yes. Well, that was taken from the
Fordism. It's Fordism. I mean, that's what he advocated.
Well, yeah, because he made the assembly line for manufacturing vehicles as a smart, cost-effective way of building items.
I love that Ford Fusion, though. I'm not going to lie to you. So anyway, development news shows that are being developed for television. And I guess we need to do one more redo. Pan Am, did you see that? We were asking the question last week of what's going to happen with that, where you've got a show that's a big hit foreign and not here, and they've been sitting around waiting, for a back-end order of episodes to finish the first season.
Oh, dear.
And that order came. One more episode.
No.
Yeah. And then we're replacing you after for the mid-season, and we'll let you know May.
Wow.
About next season.
Next season. So keep that plane set in the storage room.
And you've got to think that much like Southland or some other shows, you know, there's got to be some kind of discussion going on of how can we still make money off this without needing to produce it for American television or at least for network television, where it doesn't fit the economic framework that is needed for a network show.
Yeah. Well, I imagine that means shooting overseas somewhere. I mean, can you do that? I don't even know how foreign rules
or
work.
Cut the budget by a great deal by cutting down the cast.
Yeah, move to Louisiana.
Southland.
Yeah.
Do it here, put it on a sister cable network, and then continue to sell it overseas.
Wow.
There, I've just solved the problem for you. Sci-Fi, formerly Sci-Fi, it's now S-Y-F-Y, right, as opposed to Sci-Fi, S-C-I,
Sci-Fi. Sci-Fi.
It bought a series from executive producer Jack Black.
What?
Ghost Girls is a comedic take on popular paranormal procedures, like procedurals.
Procedurals, yeah.
Like Medium and Ghost Whisperer.
Yeah.
It stars two women, London Blasucci, who improv a two-women show called Beans, Have you heard this?
No,
this is their
Beans.
Improv, their two-woman improv show, Beans. Okay. Anyway, it's going to star them as two women, Heidi, who has self-proclaimed psychic abilities, and Angelica, who is a tech whiz. And together they attempt to solve paranormal mysteries each week while trying to prove to themselves and their customers that they are competent ghost hunters.
This sounds like Psych.
Exactly.
It sounds like
Isn't
Psych
it a
for
female
ghosts.
Psych?
It's
and what,
sir,
what network is Psych on?
The Psych is on...
USA.
USA, yeah.
So that's just...
The same... Chasing.
Hey,
the same,
we'll do Psych, but with
chicks. Yeah.
Now, I don't know these two women. They may be brilliant improv.
Funny, maybe.
So maybe.
Yeah. But. I mean, I certainly like Psych. I know you don't. Shatner was on it last week, and man, he was funny in it.
Wow. There's,
I know. But still not going to make you watch it.
No.
Because it's jokey.
I can't guarantee that I will live to 150 and have the time for it. Two. From Jim Henson Studios.
Yep.
As the Muppets prepares to hit theaters. NBC is readying some puppet fare of its own. The network is developing The New Neighbors, a single-camera comedy project that centers on a family that lives in Palm Springs and is aghast with their new neighbors, a gang of puppets. And it's from Jim Henson Studios.
Wow, this sounds a lot like Meat Puppet, too. You know,
Meat Puppet?
Not Meat Puppet. That's the band. Though it's a friend, Chris Erb, was doing a alien puppet webisodes that was quite funny.
Can I get a promise from you that Meat Puppet is something you will never ever say on the show? Ever
you don't like Meat Puppets?
And my co-host and Meat Puppet, Phil Ochocinco.
See, now here's the thing. Recently on the Off Broadway, the Muppets gang were all improvising. They were doing improvising Muppets, which apparently they were being quite naughty and racy and quite boorish. And somehow the puppets allowed the performers to be even more outlandish than you would be in a regular improv show. So I could sort of see that being they move into a house and terrorize the neighborhood. Could sort of be funny, but it also might be like Crank Yankers and that other show.
But it's from Jim Henson Studios. I mean, you got to hope that there's some quality control there.
I would think there's quality control in terms of the puppet manipulation and voice actualization. But... I wonder.
You're
hesitant. I'm down on it. I'm all of a sudden down on it. I don't know.
All right. Well, going back to the idea of funny ladies on television.
Yes, let's do it.
Sarah Silverman.
Very good.
Titular star of the Sarah Silverman program.
Yes.
Right? Returning to the sitcom world with a single camera NBC sitcom.
Right.
From Imagine, and it has always been a pet project of Ron Howard.
Right, so it's the Sarah Silverman show without the abortion references.
Yeah, Tucker probably. Smallwood probably not going to be playing God who's and sleeping with her. Yeah.
Got it, okay.
Now,
so that sort of takes her
kind of following in the footsteps, though, here, oddly enough, of kind of Whitney Cummings and Chelsea Handler.
Uh-huh. Have you watched Whitney?
Oh, God, I tried. There is so much arm and shoulder and neck acting going on. You know the move that I wish
do.
People could see the kind of the move that I'm doing. Shoulders going up, neck kind of bouncing forward and stuff.
Exactly.
It's that hands up, palms outstretched. Hey. Like a Muppet.
Like a Muppet.
It's kind of, I forget which Muppet kind of moves like that, but there is one of them.
There is.
So there's Muppet acting going on.
A lot of Muppet acting.
Whitney. Chelsea Handler, my mom, huge Chelsea Handler fan.
Really?
Huge. Favorite probably person on television.
Big vodka drinker, your mom?
I don't know.
I guess.
I'll find out. I'll pay a little bit more attention during the holidays. So Sarah Silverman's brilliant. I mean,
yeah, I think she's hilarious.
Yeah.
I can't imagine her on network.
Groundbreaking, and we'll see.
Yeah.
However, if anyone was going to bring her to network TV, I'm glad it's Ron Howard.
Yeah, with the rest of development. So brilliant.
Was not behind creatively, but certainly had to be the power behind Arrested Development to keep that show going and to give it the creative freedom that it
had.
The makers of it enjoyed. So,
yeah.
Finally,
okay,
Walking Dead executive producer Gail Ann Hurd.
Oh, I was thinking,
isn't she James Cameron's ex-business partner or his ex-wife?
No, I think it was ex-producing partner.
Okay.
Yeah.
But from Zombies to Aliens, She and her Valhalla Entertainment have optioned Annie Jacobson's book, Area 51, Uncensored History of America's Top Secret Military Base, for a TV series. And the hour-long project will be taken to networks. And it follows two men working on the base who are thrust into danger when they uncover secrets that the government will protect at any cost.
So they're on the run. It's like Fugitive. They have the alien technology with them, and they
I don't know. Or they work there on the inside and have to try to find a way to get this out.
Interesting. So I guess we'll see. A whistleblower kind of thing. I would have to think there's an underdog overlord thing.
Boy, isn't everyone trying to still recapture the X-Files.
Yeah.
I mean, that's still the holy grail that everyone's trying to recapture.
Isn't
it and
something?
It might be because of what you once said about how it's sort of the last appointment television.
Where the family sat around. Where it was appointment television. Yeah, everybody gathered.
Or groups of friends. You'd have parties.
Parties, yeah. And people would gather around the television. You don't hear that anymore. You don't hear, oh my gosh, I got to get home because blank is on. It's just like.
And I don't know. Maybe that appointment, because you know, look, the Walking Dead has a very big following, and people really enjoy it, and they watch it. It's appointment television,
right?
But and then you don't get the sense of there being Walking Dead parties of people gathering around.
No, but you do get zombie walks. A lot of people.
Mad Men. I think there are Mad Men parties, but again, the size of the audience is not what a network needs
or can actually utilize.
Will we ever see anything like? I mean, I guess never say never, but it does seem that maybe that has died.
It kind of has. I mean, the way we consume entertainment has changed so much in just the last 10 years that to actually go back to a 1990 style of TV watching, I would think would seem almost suffocating in that, you know, you had to find a time, everybody had to gather, and to gather at what the network said the time you had to gather.
Unless movie theaters, which are seeking to compete, decide to program one of their screens or two of their screens to show network television, let people in for free to gather together to watch it, and they, of course, get to sell concessions.
Wow, that's a...
Wouldn't that be interesting? Well, from potential entertainment death to actual entertainment death, Academy Award-nominated filmmaker Ken Russell.
Very controversial director.
Nominated in 1969 for Women in Love.
Right. Did Tommy.
Made the Who's Tommy.
With the Acid Queen. Holy smokes. With the...
Altered States in 1980.
Oh, right. I forgot
Crimes of Passion in 1984.
And then not Lair of the White Worm. What was the other one I'm thinking of?
I think he did do that, didn't he?
Yeah, he did Lair of the White Worm. But I'm thinking of the one... The four colors, like each room she walked into, she had her dress.
No, that's Peter Greenaway.
Oh, yeah, I'm thinking Peter Greenaway.
Cook the Thief, his wife, and her lover.
Yeah, that's
where
different.
Has he been?
I know.
Lord.
When we need him now.
I don't have a lot to say about Ken Russell that hasn't already been
said,
written about, and eulogized.
Have you run into him personally? One of your UCLA student stories, perhaps?
No, but you know, he used to come, apparently, and hang out with our friends at Sci-Fi London.
Is that right?
Yeah.
He used to go to that film festival and just sort of chill out in the theater?
Yeah, so people involved with that knew him.
Ah, how fun is that?
I will say this, though, that you know, we've introduced a new category each week or topic each week, Chilpak Hollywood Wingnut of the Week. And... and this, you know, again, it was because someone rather, I felt insensitively, threw that word around
right.
to describe some of the people you interview in The Truth Is Out There. Mm-hmm. And I've decided to reclaim and honor and celebrate the word wingnut by celebrating some of the wingnuts through history
Take
that were determined to be crazy or insane or different so that they didn't need to be listened to. And oh, by the way, they all were right. This week, I think we will table the Wingnut of the Week in honor of Ken Russell, because if any filmmaker
had been labeled wingnut,
fit the description of wingnut, we'll make it. It certainly was Ken Russell, and so we won't
Won't need another wing.
Won't need another one, and we'll just say go and watch his films. I mean, yeah. they pushed the envelope, and sometimes they seemed like the rantings of a madman, and other times they seemed like the rantings of a glorious madman.
Right.
So
somewhere in there.
That's enjoy that. Besides, there is another show business death
there
that
is?
Hit me quite. I was surprised at how emotionally profound the impact of learning of this death was. Lemley Sunset 5, rest in peace.
What? The lovely movie theater in the mall with
with
the Burke Williams spa downstairs and the Crunch gym on the right.
Now, I will be honest and say over the last few years, I maybe averaged one film a year at that venue. But over those few years, those one films a year include some films like Tell No One.
Right.
The French Oscar winner and Euro film Oscar winner.
I love that movie.
Maybe the best action film of the last decade and suspense film. Speaking of action and suspense, how about I saw the original European version of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo.
There you go.
Last year, Rare Exports, A Christmas Tale, that fantastic Scandinavian horror comedy about Christmas.
Oh, right.
Where they find Santa buried in the ice, only he turns out to be the pagan Santa of right. old myths.
Right.
So, like I said, maybe one a year over the past several years, but there was a time
where you went every week.
When along with the Virgin Megastore that was there, that was the place to hang out.
And you saw everyone there.
Yeah. You got turned on to good music.
I know. Patton Oswalt and I went to all that jazz in a matinee one afternoon. It was just like, how random was that? Go see all of that jazz on an afternoon screening.
And even as it became not the first choice for people to go and see films, it still was so important because they would host film festivals.
Yeah,
they would book films that otherwise would get no theatrical exposure, including our friend James Kerwin's Yesterday Was a Lie.
Right, that was right? there. Yeah,
and a little cultural footnote: is The Room a big deal? Is Tommy Wiseau known by people the world over? If that film does not play the Lemley Sunset 5 for years,
that was the years that
before
was
breaking out big and
everywhere.
Becoming a global kind
it's
of
true.
Phenomenon.
Yeah, they took chances on a lot of films and a lot of local filmmakers that did a lot of things there. I can't believe they're going under. I mean, guess the rent has gone up on that corner.
Well, they are opening a new art house, Lemley, in North Hollywood.
Oh.
But basically, I was looking at this. And much like in Westwood, where the Avco Cinema, the fourplex on Wilshire, just closed down this week.
Oh, you're kidding.
And so I think there were 17 screens in Westwood.
Used to be.
When I was working at and going to film school there, there's now 5
wow.
screens in Westwood. How about Hollywood, West Hollywood, Beverly Hills? You've seen Lemley, Sunset 5 now closed, Lemley Fine Arts.
Fine Arts is closed.
Cineplex Odeon. Well, it's a private. It's been private for a long time.
Oh, yeah,
we saw the premiere of Yesterday Was a Lie.
Right,
it's only a rental venue.
Yeah, that's right. I was thinking of the other one.
And that's where I saw Reservoir Dogs.
Uh-huh.
Cineplex Odeon Fairfax.
Yeah, that's gone.
Which changed hands so many times. That's gone. The Galaxy in Hollywood on Hollywood Boulevard.
Oh,
the Beverly Connection. The Beverly Center.
Both of those.
We're talking 30 screens down.
Disappeared.
So if you live in Hollywood, West Hollywood, and you want to see a film, you've got to go to the Arclight, the Man Chinese 6, or the Grove.
Because so many of these have opened up with the new seating and the better sound system.
But if you want to see a foreign film or a documentary film,
yeah, where do you go?
And, you know, at a time when Hollywood, right, gets criticized for, let's say, not making meaningful films.
How is
Hollywood going to make meaningful films if the people who actually live in Hollywood can't see meaningful films?
True.
The nearest one is going to be NoHo, North Hollywood.
Yeah.
It's interesting. And, you know, this is a really key point. How will people learn about these films if they don't play in theater.
Right, because so many films I read on the marquee going, oh, what's
that? You read about the marquee. Yeah. How about, you know what is available on demand, even though it's in theaters right now? Well, many films. Many films open on demand and in theaters at the same time.
Right.
But those companies that release them into theaters do so knowing that that's how you're going to hear about them. I started to watch on demand Catechism Cataclysm. And how did I learn about this fantastic film? Because a poster was up at the Northwest Film Forum when we were showing our film there. I'd never heard of it.
Never heard of it.
It got a theatrical booking at a place where I was and I saw the poster. And isn't that... When you and I first started talking about working together, we bumped into each other at a movie theater. We were both seeing things we didn't particularly enjoy and we stepped out of the theater to just browse posters.
Exactly. And as I do, the producer crawl where you duck your head in other theaters to see what's playing.
So, you know, how will people learn about these movies? Because what we know is spending money on internet marketing, spending money on advertising, all these things
SEO searches
is just a waste of money.
Yeah.
There is absolutely no return. There's nothing that can be monetized or like that.
Somebody has to type in the letters of your movie.
They have to know to look for it.
And
the amount of hundreds of thousands of times people need to see it in the periphery before they're going to think that they've heard about it once.
True.
As opposed to if it's playing in theaters, then not only do you get a chance to see it on the marquee, see it in the poster, or see it, but also then it gets reviewed, it gets press, it gets interviews,
gets
and
talked
that's
about.
How, so it really is kind of
a big deal.
So it for these films, especially,
ouch.
It really.
That's a bummer.
So anyway, so. Yeah.
Maybe we should start a screen here. Like, just stick up a screen and have a marquee and just say, here's movies that we're watching, and even if nobody comes.
Well, why don't we talk about that as we go to break, and we'll be right back.
The name of our film is...
The Truth Is Out There.
But it really isn't.
Join Dean Haglund from The X-Files as he tries to learn what it means to search for the truth in a world where conspiracies or conspiracy theories are everywhere.
Nobody knows how to get out of the trouble we're in because nobody understands how it works.
And I can't learn it because...
You're never going to learn.
Unless I go to your website.
truth-is-out-there.com.
And we're back.
And speaking of The Truth Is Out There, Dean,
yes.
We have a letter from a loyal Chilpack Hollywood Hour listener.
Really?
Agent Summer.
Agent Summer.
And she has a question. Hello, Phil and Dean. Really enjoy listening to your wonderful, insightful podcast.
Thank you.
Do we have a wonderful, insightful podcast in addition to Chilpack Hollywood?
I'm doing another one. I should have told you. It's not this one.
The reason for my email is I would love for you to do a screening of The Truth Is Out There in the Twin Cities area.
Uh-huh.
In fact, I have the perfect place for you. The Heights is a beautiful, old-time neighborhood theater in the heart of Minneapolis that has been operating for over 80 years. It's the sort of place that makes you excited to see movies with a classic movie theater feel, complete with a stage, an old-time organ, and crystal chandeliers.
And you play organ.
The venue shows everything from current releases to old classic films and is independently owned. If you'd like to check into The Heights, you can visit their website, heightstheater.com. Let me assure you, I am in no way affiliated with this theater except for being a patron from time to time. Your fans, myself included, would love for you to pack your mittens and pay us a visit. We promise to show you the meaning of Minnesota nice. You betcha, Agent Summer. That's very sweet. And the problem is that you're not affiliated with the Heights Theater, Agent Summer. What we need to bring the film places is people who are affiliated with venues or with organizations.
Right.
Or with who can help us.
But at the same time, I don't think it's a big deal to just say, hey, what's it cost to go in there and though we know that's a bit of an uphill climb.
It is an uphill climb.
After we learned from
really
Seattle and Vancouver.
It always is an uphill climb, and it'll become easier on future films and all of this.
Right.
As you form these relationships and everything. But really, you know, so much of the emphasis right now that we're looking at is in terms of locking down screenings in Phoenix, in Northern California, in...
San Miguel, Mexico. No, did we talk about that one?
I'm forgetting one. Oh, Burbank. No, not Burbank. Down by the LAX for the Conscious Life Expo.
Oh, yeah, that's
but these
next
screenings
one.
That will be surrounding festivals or expos or conventions.
Yes. That's a smart thing to do.
Yeah.
Well, maybe I'll look into some conventions that may be happening in the Minneapolis area.
Why don't you do that?
And then we can combine the two.
And if you know of any such thing, Agent Summer, please let us know.
Let us know.
As you did before by writing Chilpack Hollywood. at yahoo.com.
That's for those
CHILLPAK Hollywood at yahoo.com.
Because where's our screening this weekend, Phil?
Indianapolis, Starbase Indy.
That's right. I'll be there at the convention of Starbase Indy showing the truth is out there at the convention, plus doing a comedy show. It is a packed weekend for me as I fly out early on Friday and get back after the weekend's over. So looking forward to Starbase Indy and everyone in the Indianapolis area to come on by and have a laugh and enjoy the documentary.
Maybe we could take some time. It's been so long since we've really dedicated much time to this, and it's the busiest movie time of the year. Well, let's discuss films other than our own.
Let's do that.
It is the award season is upon us.
It's upon
Tis
us.
The season.
Tis it is.
New York Film Critics Circle.
Already?
Announced last week, yeah, they moved up so that they would be the first ones, and they are still, of the critics' prizes, I think, the most prestigious.
Yeah.
Picture and director, best picture and director went to The Artist.
Oh, excellent.
Best actor and screenplay went to Moneyball. Brad Pitt won best actor.
Look at him.
Screenplay as well. Best actress was Meryl Streep for The Iron Lady.
Mm-hmm.
Best supporting actress, and this is what I love about New York Film Critics, is that it is best supporting actress. It isn't best actress in a supporting role.
Right.
And so they gave it to Jessica Chastain for all three of her films this year. Tree of Life, Take Shelter, The Help.
That's
because
pretty
cool. It was the best year by a supporting actress.
Right.
Best supporting actor, Albert Brooks for Drive.
What?
National Board of Review released their awards, and they of course always release the top 10 films of the year, but they do give an award for the best picture, and both best picture and director went to Hugo.
Oh, fantastic.
Martin Scorsese. So isn't that interesting? Two groups, and both are films that are period pieces. They're both French, although Hugo has nothing but British and American actors playing French people.
Right, as one would.
How would you show your love of French cinema?
Better than casting it with...
So, and... You know, of course, they probably did that for financial reasons because it was an expensive movie. Cost $170 million to make, so we need to have...
Cheaper...
We need to have American and British
names.
People that you recognize.
Right.
So that it can still, like, only lose, I don't know, $160 million. Because not doing well, the Hugo.
Yeah, are you saying Jean Renoir is not in this anywhere? Jean Reno?
Jean Reno, no.
No?
No, I don't think there are any... There are a couple supporting characters... played by, there's one supporting character played by, I think, a French actress. But
wow.
So National Board of Review gave their actor and supporting actress and screenplay awards to The Descendants.
Ah.
Actor went to George Clooney, supporting actress Shailene Woodley.
Right, Crying Underwater.
A newcomer.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it won Best Screenplay.
Really?
Actress went to Tilda Swinton for We Need to Talk About Kevin, which disturbs me no end because... Will Tilda Swinton stop demanding things of me? I mean, I saw I Am Love. Can we just stop there?
Right.
Please.
Stop picking those scripts.
I'm not a Tilda Swinton fan.
I can hear that in your voice somehow.
She won an Oscar, didn't she, for Michael Clayton for one of the worst accents in history?
Yeah, well, what are you going to do?
Fun movie, though, that. But supporting actor, Christopher Plummer for The Beginners.
Fantastic.
And finally, we have a Eurofilm Awards.
Oh,
which
yes.
This year, because they moved up, also might have an influence on the Oscars, especially because Best Picture was Lars von Trier's Melancholia.
What?
And this has really been gaining a lot of momentum.
Yes, I've heard good things, but it's not on my list of crap to see.
You might need to change that. The SAG nominations are in on Wednesday.
Oh.
And so you may be changing your tune a little bit.
Okay.
They also gave Best Actress to Tilda Swinton for
Just
We Need
spite
to Talk
you.
About Kevin.
Spite
so
you.
I am going to need to talk about We Need to Talk About Kevin. But finally, Independent Spirit Award nominations came out.
Yeah.
And now the Oscars this year will nominate from 5 to 10 awards, but the Indie Spirits always look like a pretty good place to start if you want to know what might be nominated. And they... break up their award nominations into different categories for films.
Right.
They have a best feature, best independent feature, and they define it, which I love in this modern age of what is an independent film,
right.
Just being below a certain budget
right.
level.
Yeah, and, your numbers.
But they also have then, these are American independent films, and then they have global independent films, including England and Europe. And then they have the John Cassavetes Award for Best Films Under $500,000. So they do this. I just found their best feature category to be somewhat...
bizarre?
No, insightful of what we might be looking at for some of the key Oscar nominees.
Let's see.
You've got The Descendants. You've got The Artist. You've got Take Shelter. You've got Drive. You've got Beginners.
Right.
And you've got, somewhat surprisingly, 50-50.
What?
Which doesn't seem to be getting mentioned a lot in award circles.
No. With the cancer one with Seth
Written
Rogen.
By the man about whom the film is.
Wow. You know, so. And what's Take Shelter again? I can't even think of what that is.
Well, this, I forget the director's name, and I'm not online here, but the... Michael Shannon stars in it, and Jessica Chastain stars in it, and it's about a man who may or may not be succumbing to mental illness that is in his genetic makeup and patterning of his family.
Right,
and it is a difficult film to sit through because it is so harrowing and effective.
Right,
with an ending that redeems everything about how hard it is. And it is an ending that just knocks your socks off.
Really? Okay.
And a great performance by the always fantastic Michael Shannon.
Ah, fantastic.
So I want to ask you about this. With these awards coming out,
yes.
You talked about The Descendants a little bit last week. I have heard from you the advice to lower one's expectations.
Uh-huh.
This was concurred by our listener, Sean Parker, and by Robbie Consing.
Oh, Robbie, too.
So what I want to ask you then about, because I haven't seen it, I'll be seeing it tonight.
Okay. I shouldn't say too much, but go ahead.
Well, why, though, have critics in such uniformity fallen all over themselves? Why... The New York Times critic circle or the New York film critic circle. Where's the disconnect? Because all of you are inclined to like an Alexander Payne film.
Absolutely. I was all set to dig this thing. Maybe that was the problem right there.
But all the critics are inclined to as well.
And yet I think if you want to go back to your film school roots and write a thesis on this film, it's quite doable. But if you're going in for something else that maybe you just want in 2 hours, you're not going to get it as much. You know what I'm saying?
I do, and I'm surprised, though, that this is the angle that you're taking, because what I've been wondering, without having seen it, is this is Alexander Payne's first drama.
Yeah.
And after several well-received comedies, including the little scene and brilliant debut feature he made, Citizen Ruth.
Yes.
A comedy about abortion.
Right. Always funny.
And then followed up with the Oscar-nominated Election about Schmidt with Jack Nicholson and, of course, Sideways. The Oscar-winning Sideways. This is his first drama. Is the disconnect where critics and critics groups are falling all over themselves loving this film, is it born out of some sort of prejudice against comedy? Is there still a critical prejudice against taking comedies as seriously as they ought to be taken?
Right.
And so now that this comedic genius has gone into drama, well, now we can safely bestow many awards and accolades onto him.
You know, that's a very interesting point, because to my mind, this thing could have been a comedy just if it was played up more. There was very funny moments, even though the subject matter was very serious. Very easily, all the scenes could have been ramped up or tightened or changed the timing and the inflection on a lot of the lines, and you could have had another Sideways comedy on your hands. Because to my mind, I didn't think Sideways was a comedy. To me, it was a sad relationship of two friends and their friendship breaking apart, and on the last wine binge before he gets married and they'll never see each other again. There was nothing funny about it. There was funny things that happen. And that's the same thing as in Descendants. There's funny things that happen, but ultimately it's a serious thing. But because it is re-shelved as a drama, I think the critics are falling all over themselves and they might be unwarranted.
Hmm.
I'm just saying. That's my thing. Don't hold me to it.
I've seen a few things. Did you see anything new this weekend?
No. When would I have the time? Wait till you see my Christmas card that I worked all
week. I saw a pair of biopics.
Oh, yes.
I saw J. Edgar.
Oh, my neighbor upstairs is on a voting committee. I'll get that one down, sent down to me on DVD.
That might be the longest week of your life.
That's what she said.
It, you know, it's from the writer who won the Oscar for Milk.
Yeah.
Which was a far superior film.
Sure.
And biopics are challenges.
Yeah.
And one of the challenges is Harvey Milk. His life story really did lend itself to a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Yeah. J. Edgar, not
with
so
J.
much.
J. Edgar, which is really the story of the history of America in the 20th century. Maybe you'd be best to pick a chapter and tell that
right
as a beginning, middle, and end, a la Lawrence of Arabia, which really is 4 years in Lawrence's life.
Of an epic life that the guy had.
Yeah.
Yeah. I heard that. And you know what else? I don't think Clint Eastwood's the right guy to do a biopic. To me, his directing style is much like his laconic speaking style. It's steady, slow, to the point. And a biopic, if you're dealing with a government official, no less, you kind of need something lively and zapaz and some really great camera stuff.
Well, there is, though. Don't kid yourself. I mean, the Changeling and this. These are
The Changeling is pretty dry for my taste.
But these are films that are very visually interesting, have a very interesting visual palette. But this is the issue, I think. You are not going to get from Clint Eastwood a stance.
Ah, yes.
And on a polarizing figure like J. Edgar, you might have a more interesting film. You may have a worse film, but you might have a more interesting film, and therefore the chance at a better film if Oliver Stone makes that.
Ah, see?
Because he would take a stance.
Take a stance. He would write his righteous anger and vent
it. Spike Lee.
So Spike Lee, anyone.
The other biopic, The Iron Lady.
Oh, yes.
Much like J. Edgar, here's a film to recommend it because of the lead performance.
Right.
Much more so than J. Edgar because Meryl Streep is...
Nails it.
Possibly, you know, certainly is going to get what her 15th Oscar nomination and may finally win for the first time since 1983. because I think there is that sense that at some point we got to give her another one before she dies.
She seems very healthy, though. I think we can wait another 10 years.
But there is no reason to make this film other than her performance.
Yeah. I'm not keen on revisiting the 80s. Well,
the good news is you don't have to. I mean, it mostly is her alone in her chambers succumbing to hallucinations. At the end of her life, there are some flashbacks to her as a young girl. And yes, of course, there are the 80s flashbacks, but it plays like kind of these are the greatest hits. if you do not remember the 80s, if you do not remember 80s in England, if you do not remember Margaret Thatcher in the 80s, you will learn almost nothing.
I see.
If you do remember it, as I do, and if you are an avid Anglophile, as I am, you will learn positively nothing.
Wow.
So that's the slim flicker.
That's a slim flicker.
And,
that's a
you know,
narrow,
and I was asked
blurred.
After seeing it, like, why? You know that podcast I referenced to you once before, How Does This Get Made?
Yeah.
You know, this is a real question. How do these biopics get made? What is the reason behind it when they so rarely are good?
Yeah, I know. They're
and
hard
the
to do.
Reason has to be that actors love the challenge of playing these historic figures. So you write one knowing that you can book an A-list star into it, and if you get an A-list star into it, it gets produced, and
you're a produced
they've
writer.
Got a very good chance at an Oscar nomination
right.
because it's an A-list star playing a historic figure. So regardless of how good the film might be, they've got a very good chance at an Oscar nomination, and if they get that Oscar nomination, then this film, which will be modestly budgeted, has a very good chance at breaking even or turning a profit.
Wow.
So therefore, you make it.
You're right. And if you
it doesn't
find
matter that the odds of it being good are very slim.
And if you add a mental challenge to that of some sort of malady of some...
Well, that's why they're always at the end of their life.
That's why they're at the end of their lives. Exactly. Then you know you got Oscar gold smattered all over that thing.
Oscar Gold is going to be our guest next week.
Talking to us about how he invented the $6 million man.
Now...
Oh, that's Oscar Goldman. Sorry.
I did see the Hugo...
You did
I mention this last week?
No, you did. You said you were going to see it.
Well, I saw the Hugo and...
Oh, wait, you did.
In 3D.
Yeah.
And, okay.
You said
so
it's a film I should see.
Yeah. It's not The Artist.
No.
I think my description was if you took Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2 in 3D and combined it with The Artist and had it directed by Jean-Pierre Jeunet, you would have Hugo.
That sounds good to me, though.
It is good.
These are movies I like to see.
It also, though, at the same time, you are reminded of all other things. And there is a certain sense of, boy, wouldn't it be fun to go home and watch Amelie? Or wouldn't it be fun to go home and watch the silent films that they're showing us all these clips from in lecture style twice during the film? So, you know, it's interesting. But people are falling all over themselves, loving this movie.
Right.
All 20 or 30 people who have seen the movie are falling all over themselves.
But the critics are liking it.
Yeah.
So it's the same thing as The Descendants. Maybe there's been a drought of some sort.
The difference being, though, that The Descendants cost $17 million. I don't know off the top of my head. But and Hugo, $170 million.
Joe, ouch.
I love, though, that Scorsese just doesn't care. It's like, give me as much to play with as possible because I spent 2 years making do with less than what I needed.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
Now I'm going to take every dime you can give me and I'm going to make a huge canvas. Good for him.
Good for him.
Why not?
I say,
if they couldn't afford it, they wouldn't give it to him.
Exactly.
I'm going to be seeing, like I said, The Descendants tonight.
So yep.
We will discuss next week.
Yeah, what exactly went wrong.
So good. We have
I didn't mean to. Oh. I didn't mean to point
Well, I've lowered my expectations.
There you go.
And I've got to believe that George Clooney is as good as everyone's saying.
Yeah, sure, okay.
How about your Chilpak Hollywood Hour lawsuit of the week? Are you ready?
Yes, let's do it.
Got a fun one this week. It involves the leather meets lace party at the Playboy Mansion.
You know, again, my invitation got lost in the mail to that.
Well, maybe you could be part of a class action suit.
I should be. What happened?
The leather meets lace party at the Playboy Mansion has triggered a lawsuit filed by men who allegedly had to pay for admission while, quote, this is in the complaint, gorgeous ladies did not. one man, Steve Fry, I don't think Stephen Fry.
Not Stephen Fry.
The wonderful British comedian.
He's
the partner of Hugh Laurie. Urbane wit, that he is. Not him. Steve Fry is suing on behalf of all men who paid $1,000 to get into the shindig. In his lawsuit, Fry claims he was...
upset.
He was charged
$1,000
and very upset when he learned that gorgeous ladies got in for free.
Now, does he?
He's claiming that the double standard is sex discrimination, pure and simple. And it's about time, quite frankly, that men stand up for the blatant discrimination
that we've suffered.
The glass ceiling that we have suffered at the hands of gorgeous women. Gorgeous women, not being defined by men not at all.
No.
They that idea that being defined gorgeous. Internally by the women themselves.
They
get together in their cabal.
And they know they're gorgeous.
When they are deciding things like how the banking system is going to work. and then they decide what is gorgeous and who will get into the Playboy
I must
mansion.
Ask Stephen Fry, has he ever been...
Not Stephen Fry.
Yes.
Though if you ask Stephen Fry, that would be wonderful.
I want to ask Stephen Fry, too. I'm going to send them both an email. Steve Fry, has he ever been to a nightclub where ladies get in free? Is he suing all of those clubs? Because that is every club in Hollywood on a Friday night. Come in, my 10 o'clock, ladies get in free.
But that still doesn't make it all right, Dean Haglund. And according to Mr. Fry, offering these women free admission, he's not troubled by paying $1,000 to get in.
No.
He is troubled by the free admission, and he says it promotes harmful, negative stereotypes. I want to bastardize a line of Claude Rains in Casablanca. I am shocked to learn that an event is going on inside the Playboy Mansion that promotes harmful negative stereotypes.
That is shocking. I am also. He's paying $1,000. What was he going there for building?
He's suing for unspecified damages and in the words of TMZ, I think it was.
It's $1,000.
For a life.
Wow. Well, good luck to him. I hope he finds a lawyer.
I'm sure someone will take that.
You do?
Maybe Steve Fry.
I would think those lawyers probably want to go to the Playboy Mansion
Maybe.
One day.
You're right.
And, you know, I wouldn't sue them if you ever want to invite back.
Now, we have another fun new segment, which was named by our friend Monty Cooper, called Chilpak Hollywood Explanation of the Week.
Yeah, here we
and
go.
I am going to, I'm going to quiz you. I'm going to do a pop quiz
here
and see
go.
If you can come up with an answer
Very
to
good.
This. And I was thinking about this because I will get asked from time to time. You know, people who come into town and they visit and
lovely tours.
People want to see famous actors.
Yeah.
Right? And where can I go to see famous actors? That's
there
a question.
Go.
So how is the answer to that question, how can I see famous actors, answered in the exact same way as another question we get quite often from aspiring filmmakers about how can I learn more about the craft of acting? How can I learn about directing actors and what makes a great performance? When aspiring filmmakers ask us that, or when fans or tourists are coming into town and want to see famous actors, how can we answer both questions the exact same way, Dean Haglund?
Gosh, that is a head-scratcher, that one.
It occurred to me this weekend, and it should have occurred to me before.
It's not going to the Ivy. That ain't the answer, because that negates the second one. So I'd
and
have
it's
to
not Playboy Mansion, because that's $1,000.
You don't want to spend that. I would say you'd see a play.
Nicely done, Dean. Yeah. What have you won?
I don't know.
Go to see a play. You know what? There is a ridiculous amount of great theater in Los Angeles. It is extraordinary. I was actually counting how many live shows I went to just in Los Angeles this year. In fact, I'm thinking maybe a new segment, which might be that we recommend things that are going on in L.A. live theatrical shows.
Right.
These don't have to be necessarily traditional plays. They can be musicals. They could be opera. But they could be
comedy shows.
So many things. Readings, staged readings.
Yes.
I spoke a couple weeks ago about being at a staged reading. It's free and open to the public.
Right.
And in addition to our friend Tucker Smallwood, there's Laura San Giacomo performing on stage in this staged reading. And of course, this is the other thing. If you go to see these shows, hello, if all you want is to see famous actors, they're in the audience.
They're in the audience. They're sitting beside
you. This is who goes and supports these things.
Exactly.
To a large degree, actors support other actors.
You missed the thing
shows
at Gary Marshall's Theater where Pierce Brosnan was doing a live reading of a play where he was the last minute substitute.
Wow.
How about that?
Isn't that cool?
Yeah.
And I thought of this weekend in a celebrity filled, sold out theater at the Ensemble Studio Theater. Their home. Ensemble Studio Theater, LA's home, is in the Atwater Village Theater. You and I went to a birthday party a couple years ago.
Yeah, that was a good time.
And saw a sold-out show in the really interesting space they have. A celebrity laid an audience, and it was the closing weekend of House of Gold, which premiered. The premiere production was by the Woolly Mammoth Theater Company in Washington, D.C. in 2010, and it tells a very interesting take on the JonBenet Ramsey tale.
Oh.
And it is freewheeling and innovative and dark and disturbing. Featured a powerhouse performance by Jacqueline Wright and a incredibly powerful performance by your friend,
my
wonderful woman, Denise Crosby.
No.
Directed by Gates McFadden.
Look at that.
Who I think is artistic director of Ensemble Studio Theater.
Maybe.
So, hello, are there any Star Trek The Next Generation fans out there?
Hello. Why wouldn't you be all over that?
How about you go to see a play, a great play, great theater, in addition to rubbing elbows with the people who are sitting in the audience, you then get to meet Denise Crosby and Gates McFadden. Just because you're going to see a play.
It's half the price of the convention.
And instead of going and watching them eat somewhere or drink coffee, you're getting to see them do what they do so well, and in fact, probably better than you've ever seen it before, because they're getting to do it on stage and really getting to stretch and embody their art. And
I'm sorry, I missed this. And it was closing weekend.
Yeah, last night was closing night. She does send her love. We spent a great deal of time, because you had introduced us in San Jose at a comic book convention.
That's right.
And here's what I love about Denise. I mean, you've talked about her fearlessness and her fun in improv. What I love is this woman is so just gentle and sweet and kind, and her energy is all love.
All love, yep.
And boy, who embodies toughness more laser focus than her?
Yeah.
I mean, she is, from the opening moment in this play, so scary.
Really?
And I find that combination of being able to embody that with, at the same time in real life, being so loving and sweet and kind, kind of exciting.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah.
Excellent.
We should maybe have Denise as a guest on the show.
Why don't we get Denise to come on the show?
She, for example, had no idea that you were a painter.
Well,
she asked how you were. She sends her love and asked how you were, and I regaled her with tales of Dean Haglund's artwork.
Well, and for those of you who don't know my artwork, you can check it out at deanhaglund.com or join me on Facebook as I release my new Christmas card, hand-painted for this year, that'll be out this week.
This play also, I just want to say last thing. Gates McFadden's direction is brilliant.
Yeah?
It's brilliant. So brilliant that, in a way, at times it may be
Too brilliant.
Too brilliant in the sense that the material, the play itself may not support it. The play is good. So much that they brought to it was great.
Oh, yeah. I love that.
But one of those things where, you know, the moments that are, there are so many moments that are just breathtaking. So it was really good fun.
Awesome.
In the next couple of weeks, I'm going to be seeing our old friend Linda Park from Star Trek Enterprise and from Spectres
and
in a colorblind cast adaptation of Arthur Miller's All My Sons.
Oh, that's going to be cool.
So, and that's at the Matrix Theater. So this stuff is going on all around us.
See, come to LA and see theater.
And so maybe that'll be a new segment.
Wow, that's fantastic. Well,
you can find
every episode.
Well, many episodes.
Okay, you're right.
More than 60, I think, now.
No.
Of your Chilpack Hollywood Hour at chillpackhollywood.com, C-H-I-L-L-P-A-K, Hollywood.com. Download them, stream them, subscribe via iTunes.
iTunes.
Or really simple syndication.
It's easy.
Become a liker of the show on Facebook.
Like us.
Facebook.com/ChillpackHollywood.
It's one button, people.
You can read the blog every week on MySpace, the previews.
Yes. Come to MySpace.
The coming. You won't find us there, but you will find the blog previewing the next week's show.
Sure.
Each weekend, MySpace.com/ChillpackHollywood.
Follow us on Twitter.
I'm Phil Airness.
I'm Dee Haglin.
And finally, there is a bonus anniversary show, a bonus anniversary installment of Your Chilpack Hollywood Hour featuring never-before-heard material. We're selling it for only $1.29.
How cheap is that?
It helps to ensure that Your Chilpack Hollywood Hour will always be free weekly. Write us if you would like this show, chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com. Thank you for ordering it, Haley Main. Your show is on the way.
Absolutely. Till next week, I'm Dean Haglin.
Phil Airness. Bye-bye.